Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ancient Warfare Answers podcast. I'm Jasper Oorthuis. I'm the editor of Ancient Warfare magazine. With me is Murray Dahm. He's the assistant editor. And today we're going to be dealing with another interesting question. And one where maybe we have to run a stopwatch or something like a chess clock, Murray.
I'll talk very fast.
No. Oh, okay. Celtic Ace, one of our new patrons, asks, that gives me a nice segue. If you'd like to support us doing this, then you can support us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/ancientwarfarepodcast. And there's now an option to actually get the magazine in print or as a digital magazine if you support us at the Optio or Centurion levels. Celtic Ace, then, a Centurion level patron, has a question about the phalanx. What would be the possible reason that style of warfare came about? It seems strange to use such a formation against infantry. Plus, why a 9-foot spear? So I guess we're talking about the later phalanx. I picture two phalanxes were to be fighting would look like two bucks or stags fighting. Well, Murray.
Well, there you go. So short, fast answer. The development of heavy infantry warfare in ancient Greece obviously had developed the hoplite phalanx. In the early 4th century BC, there are multiple developments, which are, A, the deepening of the phalanx, the Thebans especially, who seem to go for a particularly deep phalanx. 25 ranks they use at the Battle of Delium in 424 BC. Xenophon says they're 50 ranks deep at the Battle of Leuctra, but that's almost useless depth in terms of pushing, because the people at the back aren't going to be able to add any impetus to anything. So 25, roughly. There's also trends under Iphicrates, according to Diodorus Siculus, that the spear is getting longer. Now, all of that may have influence on the later Macedonian phalanx, which is that, according to some sources, Philip II of Macedon is a hostage at Thebes at some point in the 370s, sees these developments in Thebes and says, right, I'm going to make those developments in Macedon when I become king. There are other arguments, of course, that the developments in the Macedonian phalanx occur immediately prior to Philip, and he sort of succeeds. But in most people's estimation, it's Philip who makes these radical changes to the Macedonian infantry formation. So why a phalanx of such depth? So the depth of the Macedonian phalanx is between 16 and 32 ranks deep. They have a much longer sarissa than the hoplite Dory spear, which possibly is a greater reach, more points facing the enemy. We're not quite sure. What does happen, of course, is that when the Macedonian phalanx is developed, it comes up against hoplite phalanxes first on, especially at the Battle of Chaeronea, and also in Thrace when it's fighting Thracian, probably more light armed troops. So it firstly wipes the floor with the hoplite phalanx at the Battle of Chaeronea. It is unstoppable, and the slightly less deep formations of hoplites can't stand against it. So it's designed as a heavy infantry formation to fight other heavy infantry formations, even though it does have some capabilities of fighting and facing cavalry and missile troops. So when Alexander inherits this formation, it's the backbone of his army. The foot companions of the phalanx, the 9,000 members of the phalanx, are very much the men he takes, and they are the sort of the pride of place troops at the forefront of his infantry formation. Now, the interesting thing about that, of course, is that when he goes into Asia Minor and fights the Persians, he is fighting missile troops. So they are launching arrows that blot out the sun against the Macedonian phalanx of 9,000 troops. And yet when he does that at the Battle of Granicus and Issus, the number of casualties in the phalanx is incredibly low. At the Battle of Granicus, supposedly 30 of them. So the upright spears of the ranks behind the first few that are facing forward seem to disrupt the flight of missiles to such an extent that there's very few casualties inside the phalanx itself, which is one of its strengths. Its depth is another strength, and it's basically immovable, and that's a great defensive strength that it has. However, it's also offensively strong because it can move in small parts. Alexander's tactics using the phalanxes to march it in echelon, another thing that he may have got from the Thebans, so that he's basically extending one division or taxis at a time, and even within the taxis he might be extending one of the six syntagma within that. So it's a very accordion-like flexible system when it's first formed. And it has several advantages. Going up against infantry, it can take the fight to the infantry and generally defeats the infantry, whether they be the Greek mercenaries or the Persian infantry opposing it. Secondly, it holds a space in the battle line, and that allows Alexander to manoeuvre his cavalry and come in for the killing blow, which he does at all three battles, Granicus, Issus, and Gaugamela. The problem that the phalanx has is that, like any phalanx, it is vulnerable on its flanks. So the thing that has to happen is it starts to develop flank protectors, firstly the hypaspists under Alexander, and there's still debate as to whether the hypaspists, which is 3,000 strong, are they actual phalangites, just the same as in the phalanx, or are they hoplites? We don't yet know, and there's arguments on both sides. So the phalanx is this amazingly deep, formidable, offensively and defensively formation of infantry, which defeats the hoplite phalanx that came before it. What happens, unfortunately, after Alexander has conquered the Persian Empire is all of the successor generals have their own phalanxes. And so they also adopt Macedonian phalanxes, which basically means that the formation starts to stagnate because they're fighting the same formation. They get bigger phalanxes, not deeper, but more men in them. So Alexander has 9,000. We then get sources telling us that someone had 12, someone had 16, someone had 20, and then some of the numbers get kind of crazy, up to sort of 70,000. But they're the same types of troops frontally attacking the same types of troops. And again, most of the decisive battles in the Hellenistic world, someone gets around the side or the back or runs off the cavalry of the enemy and then is able to attack the vulnerable flanks of the phalanx. So one of the problems that happens in the Hellenistic era is that the tactics of phalanx warfare stagnate and become essentially an arms race to who has the biggest phalanx. There are other things that go on in there as well in terms of, we have chariots come back, we have elephants, we have other things. What happens when they meet the Roman legion is you've got a formation that, of course, has had several centuries of stagnation fighting against a different kind of flexible, better armoured, better armed individual legionaries who are able to disrupt the phalanx. And the big disadvantage that they have is that when they fight the phalanx, especially at the Battle of Kynoscephali and the Battle of Pydna, on one, the phalanx is fighting on unfavourable terrain and it disrupts the formation of the phalanx, which allows the Roman legionaries to take advantage. And on the second one, the phalanx isn't even fully formed. So one of the disadvantages that happens over the phalanx is because it stagnates in terms of how deep it is, how many men there are, they're not thinking of it being a flexible formation that can adapt and adopt different sort of battlefield strategies. Whereas with Alexander's use of the phalanx, he is able to think outside the square and use his phalangites in different ways. And so it's one of the big disadvantages of the phalanx is that it's so successful that the successors of Alexander, who all want to be Alexander, but none of them are equal to Alexander's brilliance, is that they essentially try and do the same thing again and again and again and again, and they can't get there. So it does indeed become like two bucks or stags fighting, but it wasn't designed that way. It was designed as this flexible, impregnable hedge of long spears, which again they get longer, which is another one. Oh, how can I make my phalanx better than this other phalanx we're fighting? I know, we'll I've got longer spears, I can reach you before you can reach me. So yeah, there's that's part of the sort of the stagnation. But originally it is a a heavy infantry formation designed to fight other heavy infantry formations, deeper, more spears, and it's amazing at that. It then essentially is the main weapon with which Alexander conquers the Persian Empire, and it's essentially a victim of its own success. After that, it becomes, well, it's a phalanx, and therefore I have a phalanx, you have a phalanx, I have a longer phalanx, aha, I have a longer spear, and that's the problem that it runs into.
Well, Pyrrhus is thought to have maybe tried to emulate at least some of Alexander's flexibility by, at least in some reconstructions, by intermixing lighter Italian infantry in between his
in between the units.
Yeah.
So there, Pyrrhus is reputationally the next greatest general after. After Alexander, there are other people who would argue that there are some of the early successors, whether it be Antigonus or Antiochus, that would take that mantle. But it's an interesting one because the overall effect is that it becomes a very dull, stagnated weapon rather than this amazingly flexible thing that it was to start with.
Might also have something to do with the fact that our sources for the various successor wars in the 3rd century get pretty terrible.
Yeah. Well, and of course, they're most of them are writing after the phalanx has been defeated by the Romans, so there's sort of an inexorable sense of doom that this is just not going to make it.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, thank you.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.